It's very funny, this class. I had an idea of what I wanted to teach for this class. And then I wasn't sure because I thought, well, I'm teaching a bunch of classes here. I don't want to repeat myself. I want to make sure I leave myself open if I want to change my mind. So I changed the title to Fully Alive. I figured you could teach anything under that title. So what I really want to talk about today, is there anyone in the room who has never heard any Buddhist talk or had no contact with Buddhism at all or et cetera? No. All of you are yoga students? You all go here? You're so lucky. It's so beautiful. It's such a beautiful place. I thought I'd talk about something that you might not know a lot about. I thought that would be interesting to you, maybe. So I wanted to talk about the idea of that in the Asian cultures, they speak constantly about a God within, about a God that is immanent in you. In the Western cultures, they talk about an external God, a God that's a creator God in heaven. Very, very different idea of God. But how many of us have grown up with the idea of a creator God? Yeah, almost everybody in the room, right? And then we come to the study of Buddhism. And I think at times there's a bit of conflict or confusion or struggle inside to find another picture in our minds, to know what it is we're worshiping. I remember last night I was doing mantras, and I thought, isn't it weird? You know, I'm sitting here in my mother's house, and my mother was Christian, my father was Christian, and I'm doing these Tibetan mantras. Isn't this weird? You know, there was something strange. I thought, there's something strange about this still to me after 14 years of studying Buddhism. And I have always been a believer, always, that all religions are working with the same source. There isn't a single religion that doesn't say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The principles, the underlying principles, are so much the same. But a creator God is different from a God that is immanent in you. That's a different idea. So I wanted to come at that at a couple of angles to talk about it and to give you a little information historically about why that happened and when that happened historically in the world. So my sources for tonight are myself. Oh, I've got like several sets of notes here. Also, a great teacher of mine who I loved very dearly, Joseph Campbell, who was the great teacher of mythology in the 20th century, who was the person who basically lived the idea that every myth is the same myth all over the world, that we are all telling the same stories all over the world, which is a profound thing. So where I would like to start, there was a break between what they then called the Occident and the Orient, the West and the East. And there's a very important line of differentiation between the traditions of the East and the West. You could draw a line through what we used to call Persia. And east of that line are two creative high culture centers, India and the Far East, meaning basically China, Southeast Asia, and Japan. These are civilizations with literacy, with writing, with art, with music, architecture. And west of that line, from your point of view, are also two creative high culture centers, the Near East or the Levant, Israel, the area of the Middle East, and that includes Egypt and Europe. Okay? So the two eastern domains were historically isolated from each other and from everybody else. So India was the Himalayas to the north and the great oceans around them. around it, and China, the great deserts to the west, and the great oceans around it. There were physical barriers to people getting in and out of those countries. So new influences have never come to those places with great force or speed, or in massive force. They have come gradually in. They've been assimilated into the culture that was already present. The European and Near Eastern domains, however, they are in immediate and constant contact. We are experiencing this currently, right? There are arteries of transportation. There is the Mediterranean. There's the Black Sea. There's the river. There's the Danube, the Rhine, etc. Right? And eventually us. And look at the speed at which things are coming at us. Look at the speed at which the information is coming at us now. So we are cultures of progress, right? Constant change, assimilation, adjustment, and progress. You can feel it in your own life. It's not easy. I mean, I grew up with a little transistor radio, which I loved. I had it for, 35 years. I adored that transistor radio, and I knew how it worked. And it gave me just exactly what I needed. And that was about the only piece of equipment that I owned other than a typewriter. Right? And look now. And my information came as a child from the World Book, and then as an adult from the Encyclopedia Britannica, mostly. Or I went to the library and found other books to study. So the pace of things was slow, according to us now. Didn't seem so then. But it took a little bit of doing to get information. You really had to, you know, go scoop it out someplace. You had to be physical about it. As a matter of fact, it was a tenet of parents then to say, go downstairs and look it up, son, you know? Because the actual going and getting of it made it valuable and made it memorable. So historically, there were two very important invading peoples, the northern nomadic hunting and fighting people called the Aryans. They came down into European high culture domain from the grass plains of northern Europe. The other equally belligerent influence, the Semite tribes, who swept into the river plains of the Levant in the Middle East from the what they call the Syro-Arabian desert. You get the idea. You don't have to know every exact place. These invasions continually disturbed the existing cultural patterns. The Occident, the West, had a history of disintegration and reintegration. In other words, constant change. Where you have numbers of people influencing each other all the time, there come into collision a great many contrary ideas, and they must fight it out. Right? Sound familiar? Right? We live in a country which is like the culmination of this, the melting pot. Joseph Campbell says that when you turn from the Western world with its complex philosophical and religious history to the East, you get a sense of going to a place where there's only one kind of vegetation. There are a few essential themes that run through the whole system that have been there for a long, long time. So when did the high culture forms enter the domains of India and the Far East? Indian cultural tradition begins with the Indus Valley civilization around 2500 BC. The culture in the Far East, in China, begins with the Shang Dynasty around 1600 BC, and both of those date within the Bronze Age, long, long time ago. The development of high culture in the Near East, Mesopotamia and Egypt, started around 8000 BC, with agriculture, with animal husbandry. Before that, people everywhere were living by foraging and hunting. By the 4th millennium BC, in the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, you find relatively large, complicated cities. That was called the birth of civilization, right? Sumer, Babylon, Ur, Akkad. Okay, and you have the growth of complex societies, not just individuals running around trying to feed themselves. And during this time, around 3500 BC, writing, mathematical calculation, astronomical observation, and tax collecting were invented. Kings arose. Professions were created. It wasn't a profession just to feed yourself. Now you became a title. You did something and you spent your life getting very good at it rather than just trying to survive. The priests in these cultures recognized that the planets moved at mathematically calculable rates through the fixed stars. The idea inspired a totally new notion of the universe, cosmic regularity. This notion rested on the idea that the cosmos is not ruled by a personal god. An impersonal power moves with irresistible regularity in the courses of the rise and fall of the day and night, the waxing and waning of the moon, and the coming and going of the year. This idea inspired the myths of the Bronze Age civilizations, and it is the basic idea of Eastern philosophies today. The Chinese Tao, the Indian idea of Dharma, the Egyptian Ma'at, and the Sumerian Mei all are images of an impersonal cosmic order within which deities function as bureaucrats. It's interesting. I think it's really important when you start to study a spiritual path that you know something about its origins, its birthplace, and what were the impulses, what was the need to come up with it. Someone came up with it. Someone organized it, and then someone wrote it down. It's important to know who were those people, what were they interested in, what were their priorities. People who grew up in the Bible probably don't know that there never was a Matthew, a Mark, a Luke, or a John. Those people did not exist. The Gospels were called that, but they were written, actually, by Greeks much later. Many years later, they never met Christ. They didn't have mass communication. So even if they were writing, one of the earliest, I think, is around 85 years after Christ's death, that's a long time. That's a long time, if you think about it, to be writing about something, right? And be members of another culture. So their points of view as people involved in rhetoric and literature are very important to understand. Otherwise, you might be duped, right? You need to understand who it was who was writing so that you understand what they wanted to get across. And then you can have some kind of a bit of objective sense of judgment about what was the Word of God. So these gods in the arenas I was just talking about, in the impersonal cosmic system with the bureaucratic deities, they are not the controlling agencies. Okay? They're not the kind of controlling agencies that are pictured in theistic religions. The controlling agency is running the cosmos and has no personality at all. The deities personify the forces of nature. And so the deities are that which is also within you, because you are a force of nature too. The mythology of a people presents a grand poetic image and refers past itself to principles that are mysterious and ineffable. And mythology has four basic functions. One, to open the mind of everyone in the society to that mystery dimension that cannot be analyzed, it cannot be talked about, but can only be experienced as out there and in here all at once. Two, to present an image of the universe that connects the transcendent to the world of everyday experience. Three, to present a social order by which people will be coordinated with the mystery. So the king was seen as the center of radiating light. His crown represented the light of the sun or the moon. His court was made in hierarchic levels, like the planets, wearing the costumes of the cosmos. They say that the early cultures of Apollo also kept this hierarchic view of the sun as the most powerful being. Louis XIV was called the Sun King. Four, to carry the individual through the stages of life, from childhood dependence to adult responsibility, old age, and death. So the great cosmos, the individual, and the order of society are all one great unit, pointing to the mystery dimension. This underlies Eastern beauty, their cities, their philosophies, their poetry, their art, their music. The fundamental thought, the mysterious ultimate truth, is absolutely beyond all definition. If you ask, is God merciful? Is he just? Is he loving? Does he love me? Does he love my people more than others? Am I chosen and others rejected? This is kindergarten stuff from the point of view of Eastern philosophy. The forms of sensibilities of time and space, all of these are functions of human thought, and the mystery that you are seeking lies beyond it. So really the subject of my talk today is this mystery, because when I say that we are confused, we will be confused until we're not, because it is a mystery. What we are aiming our lives at, if we're on a spiritual path, if we're studying these kinds of things and we're interested in becoming more enlightened, becoming like an enlightened being, becoming an enlightened being, we are going to have to be holding this mystery right in front of us, smack in our faces, challenging us all the time. But yeah, but what about this? But what about this? But what about this? Right? And we have to have the courage to just keep stepping forward in the face of the fact that we don't know. I had a wonderful older man psychologist once say to me, Lindsay, put on the white robes of not knowing. Not knowing is a dignified position to be in. So this is taken seriously in the East. The absolute is absolutely transcendent of all thought. In Western theology, the word transcendent is meant to mean outside of the world, apart from the world, above the world. In the East, it means outside of thought. That's a very important distinction. To imagine that your definitions of your God have anything to do with that ultimate mystery in the West, to imagine that, is a form of sheer idolatry from this standpoint. To imagine that your definitions of your God have anything to do with that ultimate mystery is a form of idolatry. A God from this point of view, your God is good enough for you and my God is good enough for me, is merely a reflex of one's ability to conceive of God. People have different powers of being able to conceive God. The fundamental theological thought is that only God can know God. So in Christianity, this is the Trinity. In order to know the Father, you must yourself be God, and that's the role that Christ is meant to play. You meet Christ on the level of the human, and then Christ says to you, I am the truth. I am the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. Okay, so he is the intermediary. In the East, that which is transcendent of all knowledge is the basis of your being. You see, there's no intermediary. You don't have to say to yourself, I am God, in order to be God. God precedes you. God informs your entry into the world. It is imminent within you. This appears in the Chandogya Upanishad as early as the 8th century. Tat tvam asi, thou art that. You yourself are that which you would know. But this is not the you that you identify with right now. It's not the say your name to yourself, schmuck, that you think you are. Right? This phenomenon in time and space that can be named and identified with and described is not it. Neti neti, they say also in Sanskrit. Not this, not that. Not this, not this. Anything you can name about yourself is not it. Okay, so, you know, It's a Polish puzzle, no matter how you look at it. It's a Rubik's Cube. The minute you think you've pushed one of the things over, everything else moves, and you're like, oh my God, it's getting worse. When you have erased all that you can name, and you can have broken through, then you come to it. See, this is like why we talk about shamatha, meditation, where you are sitting and you smell onions cooking in the next room and you think, ooh, I'd really like to go have lunch. But what you're doing in shamatha meditation is you're just going now, 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 now. So you're breaking up those sentences, I now, wish, now, I'd, now, like, now, to have now, lunch, now, 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 until that thought arises and falls away. And this is why you're working in meditation that way, because what you can name lunch is not it. There is no external source of happiness for anyone that is real happiness. You have to stay in that effort of now, 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 until vipassana breaks through, until you have an insight, a real insight, and ultimately a direct insight of what they call emptiness, of the fact that everything is nothing but flow, and the world has been a projection of your mind. It's not out there like a movie set that you step onto and react to, because that would be an objective world. And who would be the person in the world to establish what there was, objectively, out there? So each of us, born into a particular context, can only see the world out of the particular glasses we have on, according to our family, our ancestry, our education, our culture, the things that have happened to us, and we're walking around as that in the present moment, filled with these stories, filled with these likes and dislikes, that we're foisting on the world before we know it, practically. When we encounter what we think is a new situation, we think we're all clean and neutral, and everybody else is all screwed up. But we're coming, you know, we're always on the op-ed page, I say. You know, we're always just expressing our opinions. The shamatha meditation is to help us to be able to step back and say, let's just watch something play out here. Is it the way that I've thought, that I've judged right in this moment? Could I give this person a little bit of space? Could I allow them to play out in front of me and see what happens without already saying, oh my God, they look just like my Uncle Henry, I've got to get out of here, you know? Which we do all the time. So, if A is you and X is the mystery, A equals X. All right? In the East, in the Eastern traditions. But X is not the one you think you are. It's like they pull that last rug right out from under you. The one you think you are is not it. And the you that you can't even think about is it. And this is the mystery of the East. So now compare this with the traditions that have come out of the Near East, the Western side. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Here, God created the world. Creator and creature are not the same. To say, I am it, is fundamental blasphemy. People have been burned and killed for this for many, many, many hundreds of years. Both the mystic Sufi, Al-Halaj, and Christ were tortured on the cross. The one for having said, I am it, and the other for saying, the Father and I are one. So we're in exile. In the West, we can only achieve a relationship with X. A does not equal X. A might be able to think about X, try to have a relationship with X, try to take on qualities of X and serve the world as if we were X, but only as if we were. In the Benedictines that are silent, I asked an abbot of a Benedictine monastery where I went to give a teaching. I said, what distinguishes the Benedictines as opposed to any other kind of Christian? He said, we serve man as if man were Christ, the way Christ would serve men. So there's the relationship, trying to become Christ-like and trying to define how Christ would do it, and then to work there. And he said, "We're silent." I said, "Why are you silent?" He said, "Because we want to listen with what they call our whole hearts." And he said, in biblical terms, that means with our entire being. It's pretty cool. It's pretty wonderful as a practice. But it doesn't say that A equals X. So, in Judaism, God has a covenant with certain people. How do you achieve membership in the group? Either you're born to a Jewish mother, or you work with a relationship with the covenant, with the law. In your life, in Christianity, Christ is true God and true man. In the East, this is the point everyone must realize about him or herself. Christ is related to us through his humanity and relates us to God through his divinity. And we become related to Christ through baptism and through his church, as in Judaism, usually through a social institution. In Islam, the relationship to Allah is through law, the Quran, and through his prophet Muhammad. When the devout Muslim prays facing east, it's not because that's where God is, it's because that's where Muhammad received the word of God. Islam itself means submission. One submits not to something intrinsic in oneself, but to the might of Allah and his law. So the Western traditions, in the Western traditions, the faithful are dependent upon social institutions, the chosen people, the mother church, and the law. And these institutions have put forward some pretty exorbitant claims for themselves. And we face a lot of doubt and a lot of disequilibrium because of this. The Pope just stepped down. That's mother church. The Archbishop of Canterbury just stepped down. There are people in the conclave that chose the new pope, they're accused of the same things for which the pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury stepped down. So then, when you're becoming a member of that church, there's some dissonance. There's some cognitive dissonance there. Our own transcendentalists of the 19th century began to realize what Buddhism and Hinduism were saying. They gained the recognition of what was already stated in the Greek tradition, in the Roman tradition, and which is implicit in the Celtic and Germanic mythology. There was the idea of a sacred grove, of a sacred object, a sacred place, nature within and without. In these traditions, mythology was not an account of pseudo-historical facts that are supposed to have happened years and years ago. Rather, each myth is a poetic revelation of the mystery of that which is now and forever within your own being. If you read The Mists of Avalon, this book really talks very deeply about what happened when the Romans came in and encountered the Celts with their traditions of nature and things being imminent in the trees and in the woods and in the ground and in human sexuality, which was thought of as holy. And things began to mix in the two religions. For the West, the possibility of an egoless return to a state of soul before the birth of individuality has long since passed away. What that means is, it is very difficult to have the reign of the individual and be on a spiritual path. This is a big challenge for us in bringing Buddhism to the West, right? If the ego is worshipped, and the ego is worshipped in this country, and it's not a selfless individuality, it's a selfish individuality. Look at our attitude about guns. See, we cannot strive for a state of innocence without being somewhat sophisticated about it. You can be childlike on a spiritual path, but you cannot hide behind a kind of innocence of God, mother, country, patriarchy, patriotism, God's on our side, and violence. This is very much a huge, huge confusion in this country. Martin Luther King, a minister like William Sloan Coffin, who was a great New York preacher, ran the Riverside Church. He was the first person to allow sanctuary when he was chaplain at Yale to the draft card burners. You cannot create a holy war and be on a spiritual path. There is no religion on the earth that says that killing will make you happy, that killing will bring peace. It has never been the cause of peace, and it never will be the cause of peace. So we have to get over our innocence as Americans, that we're the good guys, that we have never perpetrated violence on the planet. We got a real dose of this in Boston recently. I was up there, and those injuries are a nightmare. And those injuries are coming from bombs that we create all the time. But we're so horrified. How could anyone do this? Who are these people? They're evil, right? We need to really take the mote out of our own eye here. And it's very, very important for us. Those of us that are on a spiritual path should be working toward world peace. We should be working toward the health of the planet. That's Mother Church, the planet. That's the mother that feeds us and cares for us and gives us air to breathe and water to drink. It's like a three-column article in the New York Times today. We have reached a level of carbon dioxide. It has been measured this week that hasn't been seen for millions of years, since way before humanity was delivered to the earth. We're in huge trouble. And we sit here like, I'll drive my old jalopy, it's fine. It's just fine. Well, the problem is just too big, bless you. See, if we are born into a context and we have our own particular glasses on, lenses that we see the world through, then the world that we recognize is us. Has to be us or we couldn't recognize it. Has to be us, has to be a reflection of us. If we're seeing a world that is so incredibly polluted that the entire group known as mankind is threatened, the planet is threatened, its survival is threatened, it has everything to do with us. And every single action that we take, even if it's very, very small, is of the utmost importance. Because if we pollute, and then we're all shocked that the world is all polluted, that doesn't make sense. If we pollute, there is pollution, and we are walking around as it. How do we expect not to see pollution if we are it? See, there's no standard issue world out there. There's no pollution out there that's happening because someone else did it. What we see is our world. There's no other definition of a world. There's nobody to come along and say, but there's a different world. You understand? There's nobody that can say, no, but that's not the world. The world is over here, and I'll tell you exactly what it's like. And it's filled with pollution, but you're home free, dear. You're okay. You're a nice guy. We have to take total responsibility. Total responsibility if we're on a spiritual path. Total responsibility. Let me just read you something. I hope I've got it right here. Hang on. I love etymology of words. So, okay, here it is. Responsibility. It's a word that none of us like. We're all very suspicious of the word. It's like, but I don't want to be a grown-up like that, especially not after the 60s, you know. We're not doing that again, are we? You know? We're not going to be like Ozzie and Harriet. So it comes from old French respondere, Latin respondere, respond, answer to, promise in return. From spondere, to pledge. In the 1300s, from Latin responsum, an answer. In the 1590s, answerable to another for something. You see how interesting language is? It reflects exactly what I'm talking about. The verb to answer within 200 years becomes answerable. Because you can't think of an answer without thinking of being answerable to something. It's you answering. It's not somebody else answering. The minute you learn the word, it belongs to you. And you are answerable. You're able of answering. Okay? Capable of answering. Which means morally accountable for your actions. Which is what it turned into by 1836. But it's very interesting. The word spondi is related to it. It's a way of talking about the rhythms in poetry. And spondi in the late 14th century meant a metrical foot consisting of two long syllables, like out loud, two long syllables. From the old French spondi, from Latin spondeus, from Greek spondeios, which was the name of the meter originally used in chants accompanying libations, liquid offerings. From sponde, solemn libation, related to spondean, making a drink offering. From the Indo-European root, to spend, to make an offering or perform a rite. Hence, to engage oneself by a ritual act, Latin spondere, to engage oneself or promise. And from the Hittite, I pour out a libation, I sacrifice. Now, I maintain, because I have worked with words all my life as an actor, words are empty, totally empty. They have no meaning in themselves. No inherent meaning comes from a word. There are 9 million words for rock. There's nothing hard about the word rock. There's nothing dark about the word rock or heavy about the word rock. It's just sounds. It's a label. Okay? To us, we associate it. It's a pointer, a reference to something in our minds, in this country, in another country. It wouldn't point to that at all. Wouldn't point to anything. Okay, so look at the etymology of this word. The human life, the human need that created the word is in the word. Because the word is empty. It's the only way I know how to describe it to you. There is a sense of libation in responsibility, of sacrifice. That's why we don't want to be responsible. No one ever said that to us until maybe I said it to you. But we know it, we smell it when we hear someone say, you're the older one, you need to be responsible for your younger sister. And we're like, no, I don't want to be that, I don't want to be that, I want to go there. Okay. All right, so we come to this word responsibility, which means that you are capable of responding, of answering, which to me means, if the world is a reflection of you, the world is calling to you. The world, everything in your world has your name on it. It is your world to use, to answer to respond to be responsive with, to pour yourself out like a libation for. Okay? To make an offering of yourself for. This is the place where you have been set by your own good actions. In a place like this, where they say a human life is the most precious thing you have, because you can become enlightened from here. This is a springboard for enlightenment. So the word responsible then perhaps becomes a more malleable, workable situation holistically for you and for all of us. So don't be discouraged by the corporate nature of the world, the way it appears to you now. In the 60s, if you had a table, a chair, and a telephone, you could start anything. You felt you could start anything. And many, many, many people did. Ralph Nader did. He said, "Why are children bouncing around in cars like footballs and dying like flies? We should have seat belts." Right? He had a table, a chair, and a telephone, and he started. Right? This was true of so many people in the 60s. It's a great, great mentality to work out of. I don't care what anybody else is doing. This is what I'm doing. See? Success is not the measure of happiness. It doesn't matter whether you ever get there. It does not matter. Because you're planting seeds every minute of the day when you start on something like that. If the whole mountain doesn't come down because of you in your lifetime, so be it. But you will be a continual inspiration to others. Continual inspiration to others. Be, you know, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. So be it. You know, the outcome is not up to you in many ways. All right? Just the actions. Take the actions in the face of the mystery. And then let it be. Let it be. Don't worry so much about the outcome. The less you worry about it, the more the outcome will be available to you, actually. So, so the very sort of first evidence of the branching off of the West, this Western thinking, was seen in the Near East, where the earliest god kings and their courts had been ritually entombed. At the end of their reign, they were entombed. As a matter of fact, there was a system in many places where at the height of a king's power, he said, "Now we're all going to die." It was a celebration. It was the high point of life then to say, "Now let the young ones have it. We've done really well." In Sumer, around 2350 BC, the king became no longer a god, but a servant of the god, a supervisor of a race of humans created to serve the gods with unremitting toil. Not identity, but relationship was the paramount concern. Man had been made not to be God, but to know God, to honor God, and to serve God. So that the king, who had been earlier an embodiment of God on earth, was now but a priest offering sacrifice to the one above. The new mythology brought forth in due time a development away from the earlier view of returning cycles. A progressive, temporally oriented mythology arose. It has been said, and there are books written about it, that the contribution of Judaism to the world, one of the great contributions, is linear time, the idea of linear time. Out of creation, there was a creation at one moment in time. Once and for all, at the beginning of time, there was a moment when God created earth and all the inhabitants of it. Then there was a subsequent fall, a work of restoration, which is still in progress. Right? We've heard this for years. In our childhood beds, we heard this. Right? There was a fall. It was a fall. The world was no longer to be known as a mere showing in time of the paradigms of eternity, but as a field of unprecedented cosmic conflict between two powers, one light and one dark. This was embodied in the Persian Zoroaster. I don't know how you pronounce it. Zoroaster, maybe? There's so many O's. Who lived somewhere between 1200 and 550 BC. And he created the myth of the wise lord, Ahura Mazda, and the evil principal, Angra Mainyu. So, the devil and the angel, God and Lucifer. Lucifer, I think, is only mentioned once in the Bible. The whole system of there being a Lucifer was quite a creation of the church in order to intimidate people. That's something most people don't know either. Christ rarely talked about the devil. It's like a wonderful story about Geshe Michael's teacher, Ken Rinpoche, when Geshe Michael was his attendant. And they went into a cathedral. Geshe Michael wanted to show him this beautiful cathedral, and all kinds of things were going on inside the church, and Ken Rinpoche said, there's a woman going into a little booth over there, and there's a priest going in there too. What are they doing? Geshe Michael said, well, that's called a confessional, and she goes in and she confesses her sins, and there's a wall between them, and he tells her to do a certain number of Hail Marys, and Ken Rinpoche goes, What's Hail Mary? He says, well, it's like the mantras that we do on our beads, and she does those mantras, and it's a kind of purification. Ken Rinpoche said, oh, good, sounds good. He said, but then where's the other door? Geshe Michael said, what other door? He said, the other door she goes in. Geshe Michael said, what are you talking about? He says, to tell the priest the good things she's done. And they rejoice together. This is a formidable teaching about what we grew up with, see? And then we have the Buddhist teachers come along and they say, one of the ways to understand how to achieve enlightenment is to be able to use the karmic system, to know that there are powerful karmic objects for you to interact with and do good things towards, like your parents who spent their entire life doing things for you. Whether you liked the way they did it or didn't, they gave you your life and they worked towards your life. They held you in their arms when, if they had let you go, you could have died. They have done so much for you. We're at Mother's Day, aren't we? So my father used to say, what is this holiday? Every day should be Mother's Day. So sweet. So very, very important for you to learn to rejoice. It's one of the four steps of what they call a path of karma, where they say, if you want something, if you have a dream for your life, you make sure someone else gets it first. So you set that up. You write down what your dream is, one clear sentence. Then you look for someone who would love to have that. And you start to go and help them. So if you're looking for a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you find someone who is lonely, who also really needs companionship, and you go and you serve them by being company for them. And you go maybe once a week to a nursing home, maybe twice a month, and you are regular about it, and you follow through. And you do it with a certain attitude, which is very important. You do it with the attitude of, first of all, falling in love. When you are falling in love, what's happening actually is that you are thinking about that person 24 hours a day. Oh my God, it's the greatest pleasure. What would they like for dinner? Oh, he loves kielbasa. Where can I find kielbasa? Oh, that's kind of out of my way, but I got time. And then the whole way you're driving to the place where they have the kielbasa, you're just thinking, you're just basking in the glow of his or her potential smile, right? As the top comes off the pot and there's the kielbasa, and they go, oh, you didn't. And you go, well, I kind of did, you know? You know, this is why I have to give away the merit, because you start to, you know, get a little puffed up about your great deed of the day, you know? You didn't end any wars, honey. You got some kielbasa. Good for you. Now give the merit away, too, so you don't get a little too swelled head about it, right? But it's your greatest joy, that anticipation. It's like giving a surprise party all the time, all day long, okay? So he says, do it with that attitude where you're thinking about the person in the 2 weeks in between the time that you see them. What kind of magazines would they like? I wonder if they like being read to. I wonder if they love a really racy book, you know? Even at 90 years old, you can love a racy book. Let me go to the store and see what I can find, you know?
about a great mystery.
Oh, I wonder if that'll give him nightmares. You know, you're thinking, like someone in love, like someone in love. What would bring a smile to their lips? What would bring that incredible expression of, oh, you didn't, to their face? And you do it with the attitude you're going to create a revolution. That if you find the person of your dreams because you walked this path, and someone sees you with them and they say, God, where'd you meet the cute guy? Or where'd you meet this sweet girl? Did you go to yoga class or did you go on the internet? You say, no, I didn't do either one of those. I heard this teaching and this is what I did. I don't know. It worked. It worked. To that person, okay? And then the idea is that pretty soon you go to the nursing home and you say, you know, I'm here to see Mr. McGillicuddy. And they say, oh, wow, I'm sorry, he has someone there. You say, well, okay, what about if I come back in an hour? And they say, I'm really sorry, but he's got someone in an hour, and he seems to have someone for the hour after that. He's booked, actually, until midnight, you know? And then you've created the revolution because all your friends are going to see Mr. McGillicuddy, too, with the idea of this is how you transform the world. This is how you do it. One Mr. McGillicuddy at a time, right? But karma grows. That's a perfect example of how karma grows. Pretty soon, you've eliminated loneliness on the planet, right? You don't have to cover the world with leather. You just have to put them on your shoes. Put it on your shoes, right? And wherever you walk, that's where it's soft. That's where it's pliable, and the earth is workable. Okay. The last step, though, is the most important, I think, because it's not something that is characteristic of us at all. As you go to bed that night, after seeing Mr. McGillicuddy, you've taken two buses or whatever, the pain in the neck thing is that you did, you lie back on the pillow, and you look dreamily up at the ceiling, and you list to yourself the things that you did that day that were sweet and good and in line with the path that you say you are on. And then if you run out of those things, you can go into your past, list some of those, or you can go on to other people that you saw do good things. And you start to develop the mind that is happy, not attached to the ego like I'm so cool, but I'm actually happy, and I'm learning how to be happy by serving someone else, which is the only way to be happy. And you're just enjoying the heck out of it, and you're grateful. They say the karma of gratitude. They say doing good things will bring you good things that you like, but unless you're grateful, you won't be able to enjoy them. You'll be like the person who wins the lottery and it becomes a nightmare and it takes your life down. If you're grateful, they say, the karma of that is that you can enjoy what you have. And they say the more you're grateful, the more you will have to be grateful for. I used to debate Lama Root on that one. I said, oh, that's a tricky one, Lama Root. That's like, come on, come on. And he kept saying to me, no, think about it. You keep thinking about it. It's just manifestation. It's true manifestation, actually. The more you're grateful, suddenly you find more. It's as if you got richer and richer and more abundant and more abundant. It's a wonderful little system. That's foolproof, actually. Okay? So rejoicing. Our self-denigration is holding paradise off harder than anything else. It is stupid behavior. It's not intelligent. It's not. No matter what you do in a given day, you know, I told a story in a class the other day that I was at the airport and I was going to get a cup of coffee, and I had my little dog with me in a bag. And Starbucks is built in a U at the airport so that you have to pass all these other delicacies until you get up to order coffee. So by the time you get your coffee, you've got your arms full of all this stuff you didn't really intend to buy. But they had these nice-looking sandwiches, and so one of them had cheese in it and tomato, and it looked harmless, and so I thought I'd get it. So I picked up this big sandwich. And as I'm holding it and I'm looking around, I'm realizing my dog is trying to eat the sandwich. So I put it in my purse on the other side. Okay, so I get up there and I buy my coffee. And as I'm leaving to go wait for the coffee, I realize I forgot the sandwich. The sandwich is in my purse. And the first thought was, wow, I beat the system. I got a free sandwich. This voice came into my mind. It was like some character in some play was in there. You know, hey, kids, you know, you too can beat the system. Right? It was so juvenile. I couldn't believe it. And I thought to myself, for a moment, I actually had this feeling of joy, of like, wow. And I realized that there's this person inside of all of us that just wants to be given everything, has this fantasy of the airport, we come, and things will be actually cheaper at the airport than they are other places, not more expensive, or they'll be free. There'll be people with baskets. Would you like this for the plane? Would you like to taste this before you get on the plane? Could I help you with your bags? Could I hold that for you while you drink your coffee? You know, we have these fairy tale fantasies. We don't even really have them in our consciousness until something like that happens, and then we realize we actually do wish for that. Because this person inside me was going, you got it, kid. You got out from under, you know? And I just had to. And here's the responsibility, right? The sandwich has my name on it. Right? I took a sandwich. I cannot move forward, you know, skipping down the street with a sandwich in my hand. That's not going to work. It's not the way it works. So I had to like be like the salmon upstream. People were pissed at me that I was going back towards the cashier and other people trying to pay. And I'm going, I'm really sorry. You know, it's kind of a long story, but the dog was trying to eat the sandwich. As I held it, I put it in my bag. Can I pay for the sandwich? So they let me pay for the sandwich. And I thought, you know, we don't need to hate ourselves for those kinds of things. We were born into a context, right? We were told, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But the world sings a siren song. It does. And it tells us, you got to think of yourself first. You know, if you don't elbow someone out of the way, you're not going to get the sandwich because there's only one left. You know, oh, look over there. Oh, I'll take a sandwich. You know, it's like we do this kind of stuff all the time because it's the meal we were raised on. It's the culture, especially in this culture, right? Everybody's, you know, you go to England, people are patiently waiting in line. You know, they don't do that here. I just had this experience in the theater. I got up at the end of a show. The theater was very crowded. I was on the aisle, so I was the first one in the aisle. Then pretty soon I was like this, standing in the aisle waiting. Nobody's moving. I'm thinking, it's a little claustrophobic. I'd like to get out of here. I'd like to get home. I had my first new bike out on the street. I thought, I wonder if my bike's stolen. I need to get out there because it might be stolen. You know, my mind is going like crazy. And then a man powerfully steps in front of me from the row ahead and grabs his wife and pulls her next to him and really, like, shoves me back. And I'm thinking, like the way you do, who is this person? What? Who would do a thing like that, you know? And I've been thinking a moment before, very impatient thoughts, like the kind of thoughts that would lead to my stepping in front of somebody or trying to elbow somebody out of the way, right? And then I looked at the man, and he had white hair, and his wife had white hair, and I thought, I don't know who this person is. This person is right now my teacher of patience. I'm either going to be patient, or I'm going to declare this guy as a jerk, whether I do it only mentally, or whether I do it actually physically, or speak it. Maybe he's like my mom who has white hair, you know, who needs to use the ladies' room at the end of a play. Quickly! The handicap bathroom, or maybe his wife can't sit for very long. Maybe she needs to move. Maybe they need to get to a car. Maybe they're giving a ride to other people. I don't know. I could make him as majestic as I want, or as sinister as I want. He's empty in front of me. But what I could choose if he had my name on it, if he is part of the system that I could be using in order to find the God that's imminent in me, right? Then I could say, thank you. I need to calm down here. If I'm the last one out, it probably would pay out some karma for me. for having been someone who elbowed their way to the front numbers of times, I'm sure. Okay? But I don't have to hate that person, either in him or in me, because it's the same person. It's a projection of my mind. I don't have to hate that person. I just have to notice, which way would I like to go in this moment, which is the only moment that's alive? And that's being fully alive. Be there now. Notice what you're foisting on the world with your particular lenses from that night and your needs, which are the most important, blah, blah, blah. And ask yourself, how could this moment be part of my creating or becoming aware of the God that is within me, the God that is here? Okay? Without getting all puffed up about it, but just saying, here's how I could behave right in this moment. This is the moment that I have. We don't know, as we found out in Boston, whether we will have another one. There have been people blown up in theaters in our lifetimes. You know? Anything could happen at any time. So, if in the next moment I found myself on the floor with my two legs blown off, how would I think about how I had just behaved? You know? What would help me hold myself together then? There's some amazing people in Boston. There was some amazing behavior that we saw in Boston. It was as much a revelation of that as it was of some kid being pure evil. This poor kid. Both of them, actually. You know? Wow. How do you get to that point? Wow. You must be very susceptible. You know? Because we can't lose our heads on a spiritual path either. We have to think. We have to think for ourselves. When I'm talking about personal responsibility, that personal responsibility is a spiritual path, people always ask me about abuse. You know, well, if someone is being abusive, then, you know, do you stay and you try to love them? I say, if you're in an abusive relationship, it is not good for the other person for you to be the target so that they can hit you again. That's karma that they're creating for themselves that's going to send them straight down. You get out of the way. You try to get them help. But if they're not changing their ways, step out of the road. You know, is this not the intelligent thing to do? It's certainly the loving thing to do. For their sake, get out of the road, as well as for your own. Don't stop thinking like an intelligent person. Love can be making a boundary, a very serious boundary. That's a loving gesture, a very loving gesture. When people need boundaries, we couldn't raise children without that. They would be insane. You know, we're insane enough with our parents having made boundaries for us. Yeah? So, the Eastern idea that you are the creator, that you are the creator God, is so extraordinary that I think we should just consider the possibility that it's true. If it is true that the extraordinary is ours or is us, then everywhere we turn is sanctified. And one of the things I really would like you to do, to encourage you to do, I grew up with a mother who had a great... I was the daughter of a playwright, Broadway playwright. So I knew about ritual throughout my life. And my mother was someone who had a kind of formal way about her, but she knew how to make things beautiful in a small ritual way that I realized was just, bless you, Chris, integrated in my life throughout dinners, parties, holidays, the way she dressed. My mother wore gloves, white gloves, out on the street. The other day, she's 97, we were walking her in the park in a wheelchair, and she said, "Where are my gloves?" And I said, "Mommy, it's so warm. I didn't think you'd want gloves." Well, I just don't feel right, she said, without my gloves. Because you wouldn't want to have the paper in your hand and then shake someone's hand that's dirty with a print of paper, right? There was a sense of she was a snappy dresser. Not an elaborate dresser, a fancy dresser, a snappy dresser. She had a way about her that made things right, made things clean and correct. We didn't eat in the kitchen. We ate at the dining room table. The table was set nicely. Things weren't brought to the table. It was so cute. When my brother got married, his wife had come from a very different kind of household where there were like five girls, you know, so it was hard to keep control over everything. And, you know, they brought the butter dish to the plate from the fridge. So she started to do that one night. It was my job as a child to make butter balls with two wooden paddles that had striations in them. And you put a pat of butter and then you rolled them. And they had this beautiful checkered pattern all over them in a perfect sphere. And then you put them in ice water and you kept them in the fridge for the week. And then the next week, I would make more, right? That went on a little plate. That was for your bread and butter, and it was pretty. So she comes to the table with, you know, the butter dish from the refrigerator. She puts it down in front of my mother, you know, like a real offering, right? And my mother just took hold of the sides of the chair, and she went, she closed her eyes, and she went, well, if you want to live that way. My mother's also a very liberal woman of the theater. She's the person who created the half-price ticket trailer in Times Square, TKTS. You know, she's a wonderful lady. But I learned from her. I mean, it was a pain in the neck when I was a kid, making the butter balls and everything. And I used to be so, like, you know, here I was in the 60s with my mini skirts and, you know, trying to look like the proletariat or whatever. And there was my mother. And I didn't really understand until I began to get older, and when my father died, I saw her sense of order and what is proper and what is beautiful and what is right about sitting down to dinner. She would put on a nice dress when she was by herself, make her dinner, put it on a pretty plate, sit down and eat it properly. I could not believe the admiration that grew in me for her survival skills. I never saw my mother slopping around the house in her pajamas. I never saw her dragged down, unkempt, you know? It's extraordinary. And it was, I realized, a kind of ritualistic behavior that she understood, and she understood how it gives you strength. So she sanctified things. And I took it into my own life how to sanctify things from her. So Joseph Campbell says, so everywhere we turn is sanctified. This can be an assumption, but we lose it in the participation. He says, in a way, in the West, especially with those of us brought up in large cities, with lots of education and technology, we've lost our identification, which that is deep and mysterious and good. Those of us that had the privilege of being in the country in the summers, really in the boonies, know what it's like to be walking in the forest or wading in a pond or running on a path in the woods and getting a sense of the spring or watching the salamanders come out of the vernal pools or et cetera, et cetera. The skunk cabbage that raises the temperature of the earth by 20 degrees around it in the spring and begins to make a melted area that other things can grow in, and these beautiful trillium wildflowers, etc., come. You have a deep sense of what is mysterious and sanctified and good. We're identifying with what we're seeming, what we're seeing, the teeming, brawling centers of overwhelming stimulation and suffering, or in our suburbs, a sterile landscape of keeping things nice. Each man's house protected by a gate, an alarm system, turned on whether we're in the house or not. A little city-state in which there resides as much fear as with any man who felt compelled to wall himself in a castle. So he said, the sanctification of the local landscape, meaning what's around you, close to you, is a fundamental function of mythology. He says, you see this with the Navajo, who will identify a northern mountain, a southern mountain, an eastern mountain, and a western mountain, and a central mountain. And in their house, in the Navajo hogan, the door will always face east. The fireplace is in the center, which becomes the cosmic center, the smoke coming up through the hole in the ceiling, so that the scent of the incense goes to the nostrils of the gods. Okay? This is theatrical. This is stuff I understand. We can live this way. Right? We can do it out of whole cloth. We can do it from nothing. We can make our house into a kind of sanctified place. Not so ostentatious that other people don't want to come into it, but where people will just feel it the minute they walk in the door. The landscape, the dwelling place, becomes an icon, a holy picture. Whatever you are related to the cosmic order. When you see a Navajo sand painting, there will be a surrounding figure. It may be a mirage or a rainbow or whatnot, but there will always be a surrounding figure with an opening in the east so that the spirit can pour in. When Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, he faced east, the direction of the rising sun. He says, when a Sioux Indian would take up the calumet, the pipe, he would hold up its stem to the sky so that the sun could take the first puff. And then he'd address the four directions always. And in that frame of mind, Campbell says, when you're addressing yourself to the horizon, to the world that you're in, then you are in your place in the world. And it's a different way to live. Where does transformation occur? What does it mean to have a sacred place? A place where the temporal walls may dissolve to reveal a wonder. See, this is the theater. This is living in the theater. And the theater is a place of absolute magic. This is an absolute necessity, he says, for anybody today. You must have a room or a certain hour or so a day where you don't know what was in the newspapers that morning. You don't know who your friends are. You don't know what you owe anybody. You don't know what anybody owes you. This is a place where you can simply experience and bring forth what you are and what you might be. This is a place of creative incubation. At first, you may find that nothing happens there. But if you have a sacred place and use it, something eventually will happen. When you are transformed, it means you have a different use. And you will use other things differently. When you go up to the Natural History Museum and you see how a spoon was carved or a basket was made, these things that people used had a deep meaning, a personal meaning. They were pieces of art. They were loved. They weren't gotten at CVS, you know, and, this thing doesn't work and throw it out. They were cherished. We still have them. For earlier people, the whole world was a sacred place, but our life has become so economic and practical in its orientation that as you get older, things fall on the floor. Sorry, hold on. Let's make sure I didn't break my... We're still recording. We're still good, folks. Okay. For earlier peoples, the whole world was a sacred place, and our life has become so economic and practical in its orientation that as you get older, the claims of the moment upon you are so great, you hardly know where the hell you are or what is intended. And that is true of our lives. This is the biggest problem that we face. Okay? I go to do research for a teaching and something's beeping at me on the screen or flying by me or some woman's gyrating in the corner, whatever. This is a problem, guys. This is the opposite of shamatha. We can't do one thing at a time. We can't even concentrate on one thing at a time. And we are very fast selecting out for this to be the cool way to live. It's not the cool way to live. It's awful. It's getting us in terrible, terrible trouble. Right? Because what happens? Okay, now the new thing and the new program on my new computer is the spam comes up. Is this spam, it asks me, as I'm trying to read the article by Joseph Campbell with a woman gyrating in the corner. And the text thing comes up saying, 10 good texts. What does that mean, 10 good texts? They don't know, you know, right? It's so seductive. Well, who wouldn't want 10 good texts, right? Plus the woman's gyrating and the spam is blinking and I can't concentrate on this anyway. Oh, I want to read my 10 good texts. 10 good texts, right? So, right, this is our biggest problem. And, you know, you cannot conform to the world and be on a spiritual path. Sorry, you can't. Nor does it matter, right? It'll be the new thing next week. The new thing is you can have your internet on this little thing on your glasses. You can be running the internet in front of your eyes while you're driving. You can be photographing people by just looking at them. Yeah, and it's out. Yeah. And there are places already banning it. It's just unbelievable. It will take every moment of private thinking and destroy it. We do so little. Resting, refreshing, restoring. We are terrified of doing nothing. We're so scared. And all of this stuff just making us feel important, making us, oh, I have 10 good emails, I better, you know. Right. You could be in retreat for several months and you would be happier without it. And the people you truly need to relate to, they'll relate to you. They'll find you. They'll get a hold of you. Right? And they'll still be in your life. So I love this. Our life has become so economic and practical in its orientation that as you get older, the claims of the moment upon you are so great, you hardly know where the hell you are or what is intended. You are always doing something that is required of you, that you think is required of you. Oh, I have to answer my email. Why? Why? I've told people that I'm not on my email every day. People used to call me and say, did you get my email? I'm like, I'm in the car. I'm having a life. When did you send me an email? Oh, an hour ago. I go, are you kidding? And you're so impatient to get my response, you have to call me? No, I didn't get your email. Take it easy. Is the house on fire? No? Take it easy. But there's a slight tinge of anger in their voice. You know? Chop, chop. What's the matter with you? You know? So Campbell asks at the end of that diatribe, where is your bliss station? He says something so beautiful. He says, the Indians addressed the buffalo as thou out of reverence. The Indians addressed all of life as thou, the trees, the stones, everything. You can address anything as thou. And if you do it, you can feel the change in your own psychology. When you take an action that is sanctified, everything in you becomes sanctified. And because that becomes sanctified, the world that you see becomes sanctified. All right? By the way you put your hand on someone's shoulder, by the way you greet someone, by the way you say hello. He says, when people go to war with other people, the whole challenge for the press is to turn those enemies into an it so that you don't know how to relate to them. Okay? He talks about the cave paintings. Ancient cave paintings, like the paintings from Lascaux. He says, I've visited one, and he said, you don't want to leave. Here you come into an enormous chamber, like a cathedral, with all these painted animals, but But you can't see anything. The darkness, he said, is almost inconceivable. You are never in darker darkness in your life. You don't know where you are. All orientation is gone, and you're in a darkness that never saw the sun. And then he said they take these tiny little lights so that they won't damage the paintings, and they turn them up slowly, and you see this glory on the wall. He said they're painted with the vitality of silk paintings that the Japanese would do on scrolls. You have a 20-foot-long bull, and the haunches will be painted around an outcropping in the rock. Everything is part of it. Chris, you have to turn off this little thing that decides at every single teaching I do to start beeping. It does. Every single teaching I've done this week. It doesn't beep any other time. They take account of the whole thing. These are temple caves, and the temple is a landscape of the soul. He says, when you walk into a cathedral, you move into a world of spiritual images. It is the mother womb of your spiritual life, Mother Church. All the forms around you are of spiritual significance and value. In the cathedral, he says, the imagery is in anthropomorphic form. God and Jesus and the saints are all in human forms. In the caves, it's in animal forms. Same thing. The form is secondary. The message of the caves is of a relationship of time to eternal powers that is somehow to be experienced in that place. So he talks about ancient rituals. He said, look, you know, in rituals, something happens. Rituals are very interesting. They're different from a game. In a game, you don't know what's going to happen. In a ritual, you do. So what makes the ritual work? He says, in rituals, something happens. The boys were taken from their mothers and circumcised or scarified. The men came at them with painted bodies, feathers glued to them with their own blood, carrying arrows and bull roarers. And they were brought to sacred places out of time. The women taken to a hut to be there silently on the occasion of their first menstruation, to think about this is what it means to be a woman. Nature does the ritual to her. She sits there and she thinks, I am a vehicle of life. And she is identical with the earth goddess in her powers. And she needs to sit and realize that about herself. He says, you have the confirmation in Catholic Church. You choose your confirmed name. But he says, now, instead of scarifying you or knocking your teeth out, the bishop gives you a smile and a slap on the cheek. Nothing has happened to you. Ritual has been reduced. He says, when you see old newsreels of the president being inaugurated, even President Wilson in his time, he wore a top hat. He didn't wear a top hat every day. He says, now it's Johnny come lately, walking in right off the golf course, you know, and sitting and down and with you and talking about whether you're going to have an atom bomb or what you're going to do. He says, even in the Roman Catholic Church, my God, he says, they've translated the Mass out of ritual language and into a language that has a lot of domestic associations. The Latin of the Mass was a language that threw you out of the field of domesticity. And it's so fascinating to read the King James and then read the new translations. You know, let there be light. You know, let's get a lot of light in here, you know? Or, you know, what? Let's put a spot on this place. What do we say? You know, turn on the lights. I don't know. Let there be light. Has that spondi in it. It has that rhythm that does something to you. It's the rhythm of language that is an indication of what the meaning of the language is. The only way we know what language means is by what we're using it for. Let there be light. Beethoven borrowed from it. Da, 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 da. Right? Something is going to happen when you go. It's definitive. Right? The altar was turned away from you so that the priest's back was to you and you addressed God with him outward. Now they've turned the altar around. He says it looks like Julia Child giving a demonstration. It's all homey and cozy. And they play the guitar. He says they've forgotten that the function of ritual is to pitch you out, not to wrap you back in where you've been all the time. Rituals that once expressed an inner truth are now merely form. And Bill Moyers asked him at that moment, do you think that the filmmakers of our time are the myth makers? And Campbell came in right away, no, he said. Because they don't hold the responsibility, right, of the myth makers. Myths are stories that make and break people's lives. They are telling you how to live. All the passages that we go through, we think they are unique to us. None of them are unique to us. And the myths are there to say, if you lose your child, if you come to the death of your father, if you find that you're, you know, crippled, if you're feeling your age, if you're no longer able to talk to your teenage daughter, whatever, the myth is there to address it and to help you come through it. The movies are made to make money. I can tell you, the kind of responsibility that goes into priesthood with a ritual is not there. And that's a problem for us, he says. So I just want to say one more thing about all of this that I've brought to the party here. We should recognize the culture that we are in and make intelligent decisions about what part of the world that we live in the present moment, in our present lives, do we wish to conform to? Things are done on such a big scale these days. Millions of dollars. A movie costs millions of dollars. I said to my young directing students at USC, you could save Haiti, or you can make Home Alone 2. You need to think about that. Really. You see the priority in the culture in our movie industry, and it's not nice. It's not. You need to think about aspects of your culture and whether you want to conform to them or not. Because to be able to handle a certain sense of being alone is essential to being on a spiritual path. If you are the creator, right, you are moving in and out of a populated world, a world full of stunning, miraculous events, extraordinary people, beautiful sights, animals, horrendous things happening, etc., which is the minute you see one of those that you don't like, look to yourself. Don't start rejecting the world because you're just cutting off your own arm. You're just cutting off your own leg. That is part of you. It's part of you that you need to look at. Do you want to see that? Right? Do you want to be that? Then stop. Then stop doing that you see. It's not coming at you. It's coming from you. And you could even hold the world because it's empty and it's a changing thing, so it's not one way or another, as an extremely enlightened place where there are angels around you just holding up the mirror a few times a day to say, we think you might want to take a look here. This might help. You know, this might help. This might help, right? This is actually how you look. You like it? Take a look. Take a look. A little closer, right? We might actually be being taught all day long, being helped all day long, rather than it's us against the world. This is a battle we can never win. So, I've been so moved by this thing that I read by Thich Nhat Hanh this last week, where he said, what kind of God would offer a paradise realm that you could not imagine? Now, we just read earlier that the God that you are is not the person that you imagine yourself to be now. Those two thoughts are not in conflict. Your world is the product of your imagination. If you can imagine this world, you can imagine another. It's pretty complex what you've imagined. It's pretty complex what you've produced. Don't lose faith that you can't deliver, that you can't produce something just as elaborate, but on a scale of beauty that right now perhaps you don't have the faith that you could participate in. That bhakti yoga he talks about. One step at a time. Like an artist, you don't paint the whole thing at once. You do the background, and then you do the land, and then you do the water, and then you do the land behind the water, and then you do the hills, and then you do the big trees, and then you do the smaller shrubs, and then you do the people on the beach, or whatever. It's just a work of art, just like that. Just don't worry if you're not making some huge gesture. Small. Karma grows. Karma expands. Right? And I feel that if you love your world and you have great compassion for everything that you've created, suffering and not suffering, you see that as a reflection of you, then you can define yourself as an extremely compassionate being, like a creator God. You know, they say God gives the minimum of protection and the maximum of support. It's a wonderful, wonderful thought. Because no divine being takes it away for you. Why don't they do that if they're also such hot stuff? Because the point is for you to do it. The point is for you to be God. Our own modern physics says this, that the world is built holographically along with the universe, that in any little object that you see, there is a hologram of the whole. Any little tiny thing that you see, there is all that it takes to create the entire universe from. Like a seed. Right. And your consciousness is a seed planter. So any little gesture you make can contain this universe that you are going to create. And you will feel it like the Indian holding the pipe to the sky. You'll feel the difference as you sanctify the world wherever you go. You know, what else are you going to do? Check your email, right? Decide what's spam, you know, or pick up your 10 good messages. All right? Think bigger. Okay. I want to just read one little poem before I stop. This will be part of our dedication. We'll dedicate the fact that we were here and we weren't clubbing. Well, this. Really, nothing wrong with clubbing. This is by the poet Hafiz. What can you see of existence's attempt to honor you? When you keep turning back to a time where there is some event you seem to take part in, that may cause you to lower your head and whisper again, "I am sorry." We are waiting for you to arrive at your own coronation. But you really can't accept the crown with any regrets in your past. Where does that then leave you in line for the throne? What can you see of every object's attempt to pay homage to you because of your divine lineage if you are stuck in any kind of confessional? All happenings needed to be. Accept that, my dear. Ask for forgiveness one more time if you must. Ask for forgiveness one more time if you must. Then move on to your glory and sublime reign. And he also wrote, "Spare the world your ideas of good until you know all is good. Spare the world your ideas of right until you know that all is holy." So we dedicate this time that we've spent together to the whole, to the great wish that everyone on the planet could come to understand that they are not wretched, that they aren't a disappointment to their God. But they can become the equal of their God. I thank you for the great privilege of teaching you.